This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net and by Violet Design Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt.
On This Week in Radio Tech, is radio about to get something that television's had for years? Maybe it's EPG.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And on this episode, Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, Tom Ray, and special guest, Skip Peasy.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hi there, and welcome in to This Week in Radio Tech. It's episode number 11. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and we're so glad that you could join us. This is the podcast that is all about radio technology, audio technology, RF transmission and reception technology, digital radio, digital streaming. Hey, if it's audio and a radio engineer is responsible for it, we're probably going to talk about it at some point. And as I said, I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. I'm employed by the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia, so there's my disclaimer. And we have a few other co-hosts with us, as usual this week. Our usuals begin with Tom Ray from New York. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kirk. How you doing tonight?
I am good. How are you?
Oh, doing very well, though a little bit chilly up here in New York.
Now, Tom, you're the VP of Engineering for Buckley, yeah?
For Buckley Radio, and I work out of WOR in New York City, one of the nation's premier and pioneering stations.
50,000 watt clear,
you bet,
channel station.
Oh, yeah.
What's your frequency there, 700 and something?
710.
710. All right, that little crystal's just vibrating away 710,000 times a second, isn't it?
Actually, what's really cool is when we cleaned out the old transmitter site, I found one of the original crystals from the original transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very cool. And it's a little glass bottle, and it's just very cool. It's nice. It's good to have.
Not to run off on a tangent, but back in 19, was it 40 or 41, when everybody had to change 40, when everybody had changed frequencies?
Mm-hmm.
Did WOR change frequencies at that point?
No, 710 was one of the frequencies that didn't have to move.
Wow. All right. Hey, also with us from the New York City area, in fact, from Manhattan itself, is Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm lovely. How's your weather in Manhattan?
Actually, it's clear skies, wind chill of around 30 degrees, and it's getting quite chilly.
Yeah, I bet.
Yes.
Have you guys had snow there?
Oh, yeah.
We had some snow north of the city. So far in the city itself, just a dusting.
Ah, all right. Well, Chris, you work for CBS Radio.
Yes, I work for the 6 radio station cluster here in New York City, and it's quite a busy day.
Also with us from Milwaukee, Chris Tarr with Entercom. Hi, Chris.
Hello there.
Yeah, otherwise known as the Geek Jedi.
That is correct, sir. And I'll tell you, it's freaking cold out here, man. I'm telling you. It's 12 degrees here right now.
12 degrees?
Oh, and man. It's a little over a foot of snow on the ground.
Jeez. This is the Geek Jedi you're looking for.
Yeah.
And, Chris, you also do engineering for Entercom in Milwaukee and where? Madison?
That's right. The 3 radio stations in Milwaukee and the 3 radio stations in Madison.
All right. Well, cool. Our special guest this time, and we'll go ahead and bring him on in because he's here, is Skip Peasy. Hello, Skip.
Hi, guys. Welcome. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. Skip, your disclaimer is... Well, pretty general. You're in business for yourself, right?
That's it. And so as a result, hard to find a conflict of interest there. I am a consultant and occasional contributor to various publications, but that's about as far as it goes.
We'll mention this at the end of the show and in the show notes, but Skip's website is Skip Peasy. That's PIZZI, skippeasy.com. And you'll find everything Skip there, including a link to a book that you recently co-authored. You want to spend a second and tell us about that?
Sure. Steve Church from Telos, Axia, Omnia, Empire, and I co-wrote a book on audio over IP for the professional applications, primarily considering radio stations for that. And it's been published by Focal Press just about a month or so ago. So if it's available on the website there or on Amazon or a Focal site, and we had a great time doing it. So hopefully you'll have just as much fun reading it. It's the first book of its kind, as far as we know, on this topic for, but obviously a pretty hot topic among all kinds of radio station upgrades and new facilities. Most folks are at least considering it, if not actually implementing it. But first book out there on it. It's pretty generic for audio over IP, but it does consider where it has to the specifics of the live wire format, which is, of course, Axia Audio's instance of AOIP. And it's the one, of course, that's at this point at least the most implemented around the world. So should be a good read for anybody that's interested in or looking into that, or in fact may have already implemented a system.
And even though the book does use a lot of live wire by Telos as an example, and when talking about IP concepts, I do know in talking to the R&D engineers at Telos and a good deal of experience myself that the guys at Telos tried to make LiveWire just as generic as possible and have it work. They tried not to do any funny special things that only they could do. They really tried to make it as generic as possible.
Well, and that's the advantage of using an IP-based system, just like using any other kind of general-purpose computing platform for audio, where we just gain so much cost effectiveness by doing that. In this case, you can go to Office Max and buy a new Ethernet switch for this system if you needed to, and you gain all that cost effectiveness there. The only reason you do need even a little bit of secret sauce or special proprietary additions from various manufacturers is to get the latency down to what professional users require, and all the systems that I know of that do this do it pretty well in getting their latency down. But unfortunately, you end up having to go with one vendor. But that's kind of what you would do when you're building a new facility anyway, just in terms of keeping the control surfaces all the same for your operators and so forth. And it's hard to go wrong with an established company in that respect. And those are the only folks that are really kind of doing this right now. But as you say, the advantage, since it is a primarily a cost effectiveness move that would take you this way, and ease of setup in terms of building a new facility with minimum number of wires and so forth, you might as well make it as close to the standard IP as you can, with that one exception of trying to keep the latency to what pros need, which is a little bit more than the regular IETF standards do, at least at this point. We may see a standard either in IEEE's or IETF's or even AES's world someday soon that makes all this stuff work together, just like regular analog audio plugs in or AES-3 plugs in. But at this point, we're still in that one top layer, last millimeter of proprietary on top of otherwise standard IP stuff or AOIP for the pros.
Skip, I'm blown away. You know more about this stuff than I thought you did, but I thought you would. But obviously, you co-authored a book about it. So what should I expect?
Well, yeah, you got to do a little homework there for for that purpose, to fill a few hundred pages.
Skip, for our listeners who haven't met you yet, I guess most people might know you from either your work at Radio World in doing a frequent, if not every article, every issue column, or I think I met you, I guess you were just out of NPR when I met you some probably 15 years ago or so.
Right, yeah, I started back in the late 70s at NPR, and then moved on to Intertech, what was Intertech Publishing back in the in 1990, yeah. Worked with them on Broadcast Engineering Magazine, and started I was there when we split the magazine into two, one for radio, one for TV. It was called BE Radio then, now just called Radio Magazine. And then I was recruited out to Microsoft and hired our old buddy Chris Shearer out of Cleveland, WMMS, to come down and take over the radio magazine that we had started, and it's still in his able hands. And I spent about a dozen years at Microsoft and retired from there last year in 08, and have been having fun consulting since. So that's my quick bio.
Well, if you want some of Skip's immense background and thinking power to go to work for you, you can certainly visit his website at skippeasy.com. Skip, and of course, you're welcome to join in our conversation. Usually the first 20 minutes of our show, we talk about some topical news items. And then as we move into the special guest part of the show later on, Skip will be talking about a lot of new technologies that are coming up for radio and audio listening, including the Radio Electronic Program Guide project. So we'll be checking in with Skip about that in just a few minutes. Let's cover a couple new things that are in the news, making news today. We have a report that Google's specs for the Nexus One have been leaked. This is apparently Google's first phone, and the clever folks at a company or an outfit called These Are the Droids. Well, they've analyzed the Android 2.1. ROM, or read-only memory, for the Nexus One. They've discovered specs for the Nexus One. Who brought this to my attention? Tom, was this you that brought it up?
That was me.
Yeah. What did you think about this story, and what's the most interesting thing for broadcasters about this new phone that's going to come out from Google?
Well, I think it's interesting that radio is included on the phone, which is a good thing, because up till now it's been MP3s. And I understand why they do this.
What by radio? Do you mean streaming radio?
No. Broadcast radio.
You mean
according to that, there's an FM tuner in this thing.
An FM chipset.
Yep.
Okay.
And that's good. And like I said, I understand why they do this, because the first reason, it'd probably be a little hard to get a decent loop antenna into a tiny little cell phone like that. But and second of all, it's probably the processor makes too much noise. But boy, I tell you, they're putting FM in there, and what's going to happen to AM?
Yeah, I know it's disappointing for AM broadcasters, especially the big guys who haven't given up on AM yet. They still get a large amount or all their income from AM broadcasting.
Oh, of course,
it's very important in quite a few markets.
And it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
That's all right, though, because I get the local AM station on my toaster, so it's all works out at the end.
Your toaster has the AM chipset, huh?
Yeah, it's fine.
Good. Well, it's okay. It makes a great dummy load.
I'm curious. Does anybody know about the chipset? Is it just for FM, or is this an RF chipset that handles several technologies either simultaneously or one at a time, like Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, FM? Is this all coming out of one set of hardware or different pieces?
If I could weigh in, Skip here, I don't know this specific one, but I know that, and you guys probably all know this too, the iPhone has that kind of a chip. When they went to 3GS on the iPhone, they went from what had been separate Bluetooth and Wi-Fi chips into one, made by Broadcom in this case, that is a single Wi-Fi Bluetooth chip that also, just for fun, includes an FM tuner in there. However, and this is the same caution I would give to looking a little deeper at the Google phone to see if we even know or can know this yet. That FM chip is not hooked up to anything in the iPhone 3GS. It may be in the future, but at this point, we don't believe it's even hooked up to an antenna. Certainly, the audio isn't connected at this point to the software on the device, so you can't get to the chip. But it, like I say, it may not even be in terms of hardware really usable anything that might just be a software upgrade. You might actually have to get a new phone. There's a lot of leaks about, or not leaks so much. Apple doesn't hardly ever leak, but there's a lot of rumors about whether or not the next gen iPhone hardware will include the active FM radio like they've introduced into the iPod Nano 5 recently, and that was a nice thing to see. Again, FM only, but with a pause buffer, and that's a big deal for me. That's something I've been to see for a long time. 15
for radio
pause buffer. Yeah, and so it could mean even, you know, the DVR for radio or the AVR, whatever, or DAR, that would be, the recorder for radio in the future, which we could talk more about with when we get to talk about EPG. But the point being that whether or not this, just because that chip is in there doesn't mean there's actually going to be radio on it. And the final point I'll mention is that the decision on that, or at least a very strong influencer of that decision, will be what the carrier wants. That we say this is a Google phone, but we don't know if it's T-Mobile's going to offer it, AT&T is going to offer it, who the actual carrier, if there's one exclusive like there is still with the iPhone, or multiple carriers will actually allow the FM tuner to be turned on. And in this country, uniquely to the planet pretty much, those carriers call the shots on what is on the phones, because they also subsidize the cost of them to their users. So it's the old golden rule. Yeah. You as the gold makes the rules. So this is a question that we'll still have to wait and see about.
The word on the street so far, though, is that Google is going to sell it direct, as well as possibly find a part, a T-Mobile or something like that.
Hey, Chris, you still there? We only heard part of that.
Oh, I'm here.
Okay. You'd think a Google phone would be free, just ad-supported.
Well, yeah, we'll see if they actually will. If that means they're going to put their own cell phone network up, I kind of wonder about that. But
well, it's supposed to be a GSM phone that will work on a GSM carrier, so that's where they got that direct thing from.
Hmm. Well, do you guys know about Google Voice?
I use Google Grand Voice. Central.
Yeah, well, I've got a Google Voice phone number. I was invited to sign up for one. I can aim it any place I want. I wonder if that's a precursor to what's coming.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
I'm sure there'll be a dovetailing between the Google Voice service and a Google phone. But as Skip mentioned, it may depend on what the carrier wants. Now, can you think of any reason why a carrier wouldn't want the FM tuner turned on?
Well, sure, why we don't have very many in this country. It's because when you're using that device to listen to the FM, you're not making calls, probably not doing much else that they make money on. So, and you're using up the battery. So not too much, but you are basically not. There's no value in having an FM tuner added to a phone from the phone company's perspective. In fact, there may be a disadvantage to it, a disincentive. So that's why you don't see it right now.
If they could monetize that with iTunes tagging, though, then that might make the difference for them.
It could. Then something's got to make them have some interest in it. And basically, this an FM broadcaster, or for that matter, an ATSC mobile DTV, which is going to be the next issue on that plate of possible applications and device hardware elements on the handsets. These are things that just basically leapfrog or subvert the telco network, and that's not necessarily in their interest unless something is put in there that does line their pockets a little bit with it. Otherwise, they're not going to put it on the device and then subsidize the device with those kinds of features on there.
That's exactly what it is. Because if you want to watch video on your telephone, say with Verizon's VCast service, they make money off it because it's the MediaFlow product and it's a TV tuner in the phone. That's the only reason they let that Channel 55 tuner work. Otherwise, they can't do anything with FM at the moment because there's no model that allows them to tap into it.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
That's really what it comes down to. It's just the money. Skip's totally correct. It's what they get out of it. Otherwise, you're going to tie up their network bandwidth. And with EVDO, you can't have the tuner going and then try to make a phone call at the same time, and they'll get all the complaints from people saying something's wrong with my phone.
Right. That's another issue. And Qualcomm developed MediaFlow with the express purpose of offering it to the cell phone community, the wireless community, and exactly. It puts it under their control. Whereas straight over the air broadcast, whether it's FM or even HD radio, or as we say, this next thing with ATSC mobile TV, DTV, that's not going to be going, you know, that would be direct from the broadcaster to the device, to the handset. So there may be devices that are made like that, like we've seen, but whether or not include a phone, you know, Zoom has had FM from day one, but it doesn't have a phone. The iPod, the new one, finally has FM built in, but again, no phone. So we haven't yet seen a device that's a real 3G phone with an FM tuner in it, and still question whether we will.
Well, we'll have to see what happens. In other countries, do we see a lot more uptake of FM tuners in phones? It seems like I've seen this in other countries where quite a few handsets have FM tuners already.
Yeah, phones much more frequently have FM tuners in other countries because there the telco operators don't have nearly the power or the influence on what gets put on the device. They do have some with the manufacturers, but basically everything is GSM over there. You buy your phone not through a telephone company, but just at a regular electronics store, knowing that your existing SIM card will just work, and you can pick your network, but you can also pick your functionalities, your components, and you see a lot more FM tuners in phones. There's even a few in this country that use the same product that has the FM tuner in it, but we don't even see it activated in the U.S. version of the software that gets loaded on that, say, Nokia phone. But we may see there's been a lot of push and lobbying for having this and using the argument of emergency alerting capability, which is a reasonable thing to say, even though it's really kind of a fig leaf for what broadcasters really want. But nevertheless, emergency alerting is a great reason to have a broadcast component on people's phones.
So would this imply that the tuner would be on all the time, but even if you're not listening to the FM, but if an emergency alert came along, it might interrupt your phone call or whatever else you were doing to let you hear this?
Well, that's a detail. The real reason is the real argument is simply just network clogging. The fact that you don't have to worry about the network being overloaded when somebody tried to send a message to everybody in the network, whereas with FM, you know, there's no loading of the transmitter by how many tuners happen to be turned on. You know, so that's the primary argument.
By the way, that always did amaze me that my transmitter tuning didn't change with the more people listened.
Yeah.
We'll get to more of these phone and new technology things in a few minutes. Let's cover a couple more stories. One of them is the House, the U.S. House of Representatives, votes to turn down the volume of noisy TV ads. This is a story by Ann Sanner with the Associated Press. The House of Representatives on Tuesday voted to level off the abrupt spikes in volume felt by television viewers during commercial breaks. There's a bill. It's approved by a voice vote. It's aimed at stopping TV ads from playing noticeably louder than the rest of the program. Representative Dick Boucher from Virginia, this is this your rep, Skip?
No, he's downstate.
Okay. Well, he says it's very frustrating. It's an annoying experience, something that should really be done about it. Well, we're all engineers here, and even though we're radio engineers, we know something about television. And this has been in the works for some time, and it comes up from time to time. And I've always thought, okay, well, fine, we can regulate the loudness of TV ads, and there's different ways to measure that. Are they effective or not? I don't know. But the problem, from my perspective, isn't at the TV station. It's at the cable head end where they insert the local car dealer ads. And is this legislation going to affect cable operators and the volume of their local ads?
Them, DirecTV, and every other provider.
Yeah, Direct and Dish, sure.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. I mean, you'd think there'd be some standard set. I mean, I know one of the discussions, at least on the broadcast side, has been that in the digital world, you know, in the analog world, you had 100% modulation that was defined. In the digital world, there's digital zero. You can't go above digital zero, of course, but there's no defining of levels and where the program should be in relation to digital zero or anything else. And that's one of the problems. But in a lot of television stations, if I'm not mistaken, the spots come in and they just transfer it right into their system. They never look at the audio levels or anything else. So when they switch to the break, it just gets spit out the way it is.
Well, that's that whole dial norm standard and stuff that people should follow. But let's not forget that in television land, audio has always been the redheaded stepchild, and I've worked with many television folks that they call me and say, we got this box that's called a Zephyr, and we're supposed to use it to talk to one of our anchors or somebody to do B-roll video voice tracking. We don't know how to use it. And I'm sitting here going, wow, that's interesting. And then when I show them and set it up, and they're like, this is great. You guys in radio have so many opportunities to do stuff with technology. And I sit there going, yeah, I know. The horizontal control of my teeth, the horizontal control in the car sometimes gets stuck, but it works out.
Well, you know, I hate it when my car vertically rolls.
Well, that's it. I really think it's going to be more than just simply setting a standard or legislation. It's more of a mindset, really.
Well, you know, the first thing that comes through my head is, boy, thank goodness they're spending their time worrying about this in the
category. Oh, my next comment. Jeez.
But really, you know, it is. It's you'd be surprised, you know, TV guys, there's just no concept of that audio thing. And somebody else made a very good point, which is the stuff that comes in is generally audio processing or audio checking or anything else. So a lot of this stuff comes to them poorly, and they just pass it right through.
Yeah, I'll weigh in on this as well. By the way, it's actually Richard Boucher, I think he pronounces it. He's actually a pretty tech-savvy guy. He's been somebody who's been kind of on the leading edge of a lot of new technologies. But I think that getting the Congress into this idea is really a bit troublesome because there's no way for them to really institute or really execute on any kind of legislation here. This is really sort of the FCC's area, and even they have a tough time with it because it's really nothing. It's not about modulation or spectrum occupancy or anything that they can legally really prescribe. It's just about loudness. It's not level, you know, it's not electrical or RF levels here. It's just loudness, relative loudnesses between the different components in a broadcast. And trying to do anything about that from a regulatory perspective, let alone a legislative one, is just crazy. But hey, good luck, guys. You know, we've been trying to get this through. I think Chris mentioned the dial norm earlier. That's a standard that Dolby put in the ATSC digital audio service coming out of their cinema environment, where there's a much more there's much more control over constant levels, loudnesses in the cinema environment, but certainly not in broadcasting. And there is a lot more variety of content in television than there is in a movie house, where you play a few previews and then you go right into the feature and that's it. Although you do get a couple of commercials now and then, but the variety that you would get in television is crazy. It's all over the map. And the Duro loudness meter, there's been attempts by broadcasters to do something about that. And as you say, Chris, and Kirk, the idea that the cable head ends who do this pretty much without even, it's all automated. There's not even anybody sitting there listening or even monitoring a meter when those things get dropped in. It's a tough ecosystem to try to put some kind of mandate through about this. But I'll tell you why the Congress is reacting to this is because they get a lot of heat from their constituents about this. This is one of the biggest complaints they will get from people in the regarding any kind of technology. It's like, why can't you make my TV just not get louder? And I think the end result might be something that you put at the receive end rather than try to fix it at the broadcast, because that ecosystem just gets more and more complex, and it's not getting any easier to solve. And a lot of good technical minds and companies have been trying to do it for years, because it's nothing new. It's a problem that is just getting worse, though.
So. You know, we should revisit this subject and bring in a colleague of mine, Mr. Tim Carroll, who is the president of Linear Acoustic, which is now a Telos company. Tim really understands this whole issue of television loudness and the differences between a quiet dialogue or a steamy soap opera bedroom scene and how they might be talking quietly, followed by a car commercial for, you know, the latest Hyundai, where the guy is screaming at you to come down and take a test drive. And even if you talk about level and loudness, and they're two different things. We do have some listeners to the podcast who are not necessarily savvy to the difference between level and loudness. Maybe one of you guys would like to take a crack at telling us why two things can be the same level on a meter, but yet be a different loudness in how our human ear and brain perceives audio. And I think this goes to the heart of some of the differences. You know, TV stations oftentimes they have an audio processor, and they're modulating close to 100% of what they're allowed to, whether it's the dialogue on the soap opera or a quieter scene that still has some dialogue or some noise. And then they cut to a commercial that's been really produced to try to get your attention. Why are these things such different volume? Who wants to take a stab at that?
Well, you know, we had an SBE meeting last year where Linear Acoustic showed up. We did it up at NBC, and it was quite interesting, because he had a recording. He actually recorded it off the air on Channel 4 here in New York. It was a commercial set, and they picked a quote unquote dial norm level of, let's say, -22 as to be the average level. And, you know, apparently the TV stations kind of pass these things right through with minimal processing. The first commercial wasn't bad. It was about right where it should have been. The second commercial came in, it was actually 3 dB too low. The next commercial came in, it was 10 dB hotter on the metering. And then the promo by the local TV station came in, and it was 5 dB over what they considered to be dial norm.
Yeah.
And I mean, they were one of the offenders too, but it was all over the map. And I mean, we get this in radio, but we make adjustments. I don't get it. And nor do I get why Congress is involved. I mean, the world's not going to end.
Well, and for engineers, as you said, Kirk, if you're not familiar with this, I would present one way of thinking about it is area under the curve. You can have or just where the meter is most of the time. Like you said, you can have a VU or peak reading meter, whichever you want, but VU is a good one in this case, to look at it. And in either case of two different loudness examples, one really loud versus one really quiet, they can both be peaking occasionally to 100% or zero VU, but the louder sounding audio clip will have that meter up closer to 100% more of the time than the other one, which will swing the quieter sounding, the less loud sounding element, will have the meter swinging back between 0 and 100 much more, with much greater variety in terms of where it is. And that's what we used to say, boy, there are some of these radio stations that you could use as if your oscillator isn't available, just to set a zero tone, because the meter never moves off of close to 100%. And that's going to be a real loud sound. Now, that's one thing if you're listening to that radio station all the time, or you're just tuning around and you notice different loudnesses on different stations, which is, of course, why the broadcasters got into doing that, is that the sense that people would stick with the louder sound, but because it jumps out of your radio. But the problem is, at least you're making that choice when to choose choice between different loudnesses. And the television example that we're talking about, this poor listener is sitting there and gets used to one nice quiet sounding movie, let's say, which has a very wide range, dynamic range, and then you get blasted by something that is not any hotter at its maximum. It's just up there near a maximum more of the time. That's the difference between loudness and level.
It seems that when we look at the difference in different television viewers, a few viewers want a theatrical experience. They've got these surround speakers. Right. They've got the nice audio setup, and they want to hear the dialogue as it was meant to be, not all compressed, not all one volume, but loud parts, soft parts. They want to hear sound effects off in the background here and there. Whatever the original television producer or movie producer intended, that's what they'd like to hear. And, of course, they'd like the commercials to not be overly intrusive either. Then there are other television viewers who just want to turn the TV on and hear some sound come out of the speaker that they can understand. And they might have a conversation over that sound, or they might say, hey, y'all be quiet. I'm going to, All in the Family's back on, or whatever it may be. And it seems like that to satisfy both kinds of viewers and those in between, you really need technology at the receiver that's dead simple to operate. If you're the aficionado, then you want to hear it, whether it's a football game or a concert or a movie, you want to hear it as the producers intended, as the artist intended. And if you're the casual viewer, if you're watching, I don't know, Hannah Montana on the Disney Channel, you just want to hear the dialogue and the sound effects, and you're not too worried about having it all be perfect, as the producer intended. So it seems to me you need technology at both ends, at the final arbiter, at the transmission end, whether that's DirecTV or a terrestrial television station or your cable head end, and then you need technology perhaps in the TV set to adjust how you're going to hear this. Any comments?
There is technology. This is Chris in New York. There is technology in set-top boxes and at the encoding side, and it's spec'd out in the ITU standard 1770, the ATSC, the SCTE standards. The problem is, and if you take it from a signal flow, that is, starting from the origination contributor all the way through to distribution, the problem you run into, and I think Skip mentioned it earlier, is because the dial norm standard, which can, I think it's like anywhere from -1 to -31 relative to 0 dBFS, the broadcaster has their standard they've developed and say, okay, this is what we're going to work with in-house. They hand off to, say, cable industry. Well, the cable industry doesn't have a standard they per se, or if they do, say, well, just for conversation, not to point out any particular cable network, Comcast, RCN, Time Warner have maybe chosen Comcast uses dial norm -20, but then Time Warner decides -22 is better for them. And then the broadcast channel they get is set for a different one. As these encode decode processes take place, guess what? It totally destroys the relationship of the audio relation to the, say, effects, and now you have stuff jumping out at you. And I say this only because I was at a demonstration last year, I think it was at NBC Network, where one of the engineering directors in their research area was demonstrating the problem they're trying to face, and they were pushing for metadata, which is in the AC3 standard, to be utilized, to say to the set-top box, switch to this, try and adjust, work within a window. But it's, I think, no pun intended, it's falling on deaf ears.
We really should have Tim Carroll from Linear Acoustic on. I was just looking at a press release, and Tim talked to me about this technology a few months ago when I was at their factory, and it won a Pick of IBC award at the 2009 IBC show. It's called Linear Acoustics Carbon Hybrid Metadata Loudness Controller Technology. So Tim explained this to me. I tell you what, I understood it for about 5 minutes. And then I think I forgot my understanding. We'll have him on. We'll talk about this on a future show. This does give the listener some control over his loudness experience. So, I'll tell you what, let's move on from this subject. We've covered a couple of topical topics and move on to what we brought Skip Pesey to talk about, various advances in radio listening and in streaming listening, and how the user can get a better experience, and how the radio stations or content providers can have a closer relationship with their listeners, how they can have some interaction. And Skip, maybe you'd like to kind of start from here and tell us where you'd like to go with this conversation.
Well, sure. Thanks, Kurt. Kirk, the idea is that I think we're starting to see, and I'll be talking about this at the NAB Spring Show, and demonstrating some of these items. We're looking at ways to try to make radio, that is broadcast radio, a little more interesting in the context of today's environment, which is primarily driven by new media. New media, when even though it's just audio, and that's what broadcasters, radio broadcasters obviously deliver, is audio. The audio comes with a lot of other stuff nowadays, and radio needs to obviously stay with some parity to those other kinds of content elements, and it is possible to do that. And the broadcasters have been, over the last few years, gradually trying to improve on that extra content. And we call this metadata in many cases, simply title and artist data, for example. You've seen how satellite radio from day one had that with the audio. And we're seeing how broadcasters have attempted to come along with both the HD radio metadata and RDS. It's kind of retrofitting RDS to allow this kind of content. With RDS, first of all, was that it did provide a lot of metadata opportunities for broadcasters, but it was what we would call service metadata. All the metadata, all of it was particularly targeted at the station, identifying the station, giving it its genre format, putting out even alternate frequency information if you were part of a regional network. All these sorts of things were about the station, not about the particular content you're broadcasting right now. So the only place to put something like that was in this kind of catch-all field called radio text, which a lot of radios don't even offer. Certainly no car radio really does. It's kind of a driver distraction issue in the car radio. But the radio text allows 64 characters to be displayed. But it was just a 64-character block, and you could do whatever you wanted with it. Well, you've seen broadcasters come around to putting title and artist data in that 64 characters, but they've also started to scroll it into or do some kind of fun things with it on the field that is displayed in the car most frequently. That is the so-called PS field, and that in the original spec was never supposed to change, or certainly not supposed to change more than once a minute. And it's primarily was designed to put call letters in or some other sort of identifying information about the service. And so we've seen that retrofitted to be a title and artist area that we get real fancy with eight characters. It's an eight character display. So you've seen how various broadcasters have tried to put that title and artist data into the eight characters. Yeah. You're scrolling it around or setting it up eight characters at a time. And some radios have a okay time with it and others don't, because it really does sort of violate the old spec. The Europeans who first came up with this are still kind of annoyed about this, but American broadcasters have kind of done this. So that's been one way to retrofit metadata. But what we've seen more recently is what RDS can really look like on a nice display. The Zune, as we mentioned earlier, was the first one to do this, although we've seen it also on the iPod with the outboard FM adapter, and now with the new iPod Nano 5, seeing it with the inboard radio, it's kind of cool to see what RDS can look like on a nice graphical display, where it with a pretty font instead of just these little blocky, you know, text characters in fluorescent display or LED display on a car radio. Mm-hmm. And we've seen what can happen when you can look at more than one field at a time on a nice screen. And we've seen on the Zune, for example, four different RDS fields being displayed simultaneously. I know a lot of radio engineers get one of those little Zunes just as a kind of an RDS monitor to carry around with them, because they can see more on that at once than they can on some of their, well, certainly on any car radio or most car radios, or even some of the pro monitoring gear. So it's a very cool new way of showing the stuff that we're putting out in terms of metadata. So that's where it starts. It goes from there. We see the RT Plus standard now has been released. And the NRSC just posted something today on their website about that, that shows how RT Plus is a sort of a backwards compatible way to determine in the RT field, the radio text field, which characters actually apply to the title and which apply to the artist. So that it's not this kind of willy-nilly mix of whatever the broadcaster wants to put up there, but in fact, you could design a radio that shows title, and you know that the text you're going to get out of that RT field is the song title and artist, and you know that it's going to show up as the artist, and it's not going to be reversed or have other kinds of characters in there or any kind of scrolling. It's going to look just as tight as the way satellite radio does it, or the way HD radio does it using the so-called ID3 format, which is the MP3 metadata format, and that always shows up right. So this is a nice way to kind of retrofit without breaking the standard. You're starting to see this being used in the both by broadcasters and in the new iPod Nano 5 as first sort of U.S. radio to use that, and it's a nice addition to kind of make RDS a little more predictable in its performance for this title and artist metadata, which listeners really say they want. In fact, satellite radio did some testing, and they said that the most desirable feature of service was the fact that they had consistent metadata that said title and artist on every song, and it was exactly timed with the synchronized to the actual song. When the song comes on, bingo, there's the title and artist right there. When the song goes away, that display goes away and the next song comes on. Or if it's a break, something else comes up just about the station. And so there's this real desire for that kind of accompanying information. I think the next step for this is something that would involve things like graphical information, like the album cover art. Again, things like you do see when you play something on your PC or on your handheld from your local library, your onboard library, you'll have some nice graphical content. And so this would be a nice thing for broadcasters to be able to do too. Unfortunately, we really don't have a method of doing that over the air right now, but a new standard's been developed in the UK, and it's gotten a lot of interest already in US radio circles, and it's called Radio DNS, and it's a real simple way to add any kind of additional enhancement content that you want to synchronize with your broadcast content, but you do it over the internet. And this is looking forward to these new so-called connected radios, devices that put the internet and a radio together. You know, it's pretty amazing when we think of the penetration of the radio is just huge in this country, you know, way north of 90%. Everybody's got radios. And the internet, broadband internet, is now almost as popular, getting there more so all the time. And so we have these two very, very popular systems. And yet we never had that put the two together. We've seen a little bit of convergence between TV and the internet over the years, and a little bit more of that, and it still continues. But there's never been much of anything, either a PC or a handheld device or any kind of device in the car, let's say, of any platform, any great penetration, that puts those two systems together. And that's what we're looking forward to seeing now. And we're starting to see it just now happening with a couple of handheld devices and one desktop device in the UK, the so-called Pure Sensia. Pure is the radio company brand, and Sensia is the product name. Check that out online. There's some pretty good demos. There's some YouTube videos that show how it works. Touchscreen on a tabletop radio.
Oh, this is
a regular radio.
This is a sexy looking radio. You can
yeah, it's very cool.
Engadget.com has a review of this. It's a DAB Wi-Fi radio, yeah?
It's also just a regular FM radio, too. So, and this, that's the nice thing about this. This enhancement works for any broadcast format, even AM. And it just uses, and the broadcaster, this is the real beautiful part of it. Broadcasters don't have to do anything to enable it. It's already, it's only something that's done in the receiver. The standard, the so-called radio DNS standard, is something that only would be implemented by the receiver manufacturers, in that it is a way for a radio to automatically figure out the URL that it should tune its internet Wi-Fi or whatever device to when it tunes in to a particular radio station. This is unique around the world for any, it covers HD radio, covers DAB, covers FM, covers AM, and covers DRM, and it could cover any band without having to go through all the standards processes for those respective formats. It only deals with the receivers. So somebody that wants to add a nice screen to a graphical display or touchscreen, like this Sensia product does, to a radio of any kind, all they have to do is enable this radio DNS. And then the broadcaster, all they have to do is basically put out the synchronization content, which they might already be feeding to their website anyhow, and they can put it up there on this URL that the radio will automatically find, because it's based on basically tuning information and whatever identifying metadata the broadcaster is sending out, that is with RDS, the PI code for FM, the HD radio transmitter ID. The DAB has a similar system. And this spec basically just says, here's for all the different bands. AM is the toughest one, because what they would have to put out is something called AMSS, which is the AM signaling system, which not a lot of broadcasters in the U.S. use, but it's started to be used in some places around the world. Or if you're HD radio AM, and you're then you get it that way, if the receiver can pick up the HD AM signal, because that has that same transmitter ID that the FM HD has. And so the radio then knows what URL to go to, and then the broadcaster takes that URL and feeds it with the content that is associated with or synchronized to the broadcast. It can be text, it can be graphics, it can be something that goes along with news content. It's obviously title of, album cover art for music is a no-brainer. And so it's a pretty impressive system. It also works for internet radio there, where there's not anywhere near the complexity, because you already know that you're on a URL by tuning the audio stream.
Let me make sure I've got the model of this right in my head. If we're listening to FM or perhaps DAB, HD or DAB, this receiver is picking up a few characters, maybe a URL, that tells the receiver where to go get the rest of its graphical and textual information. Is that right?
Well, no, there's no URL broadcast over the air. Unlike some of the attempts of interactive television, which is, that's where it fell short, because of all the, you had to get this format put in there. Where's the URL in the blanking interval, and then how do I go to it, and all these different formats, and you had to get it set up in every country. This doesn't require anything that to be put into the broadcast signal that you're not already putting out if you're doing RDS. So in other words, the radio will, you tune to 105.7 FM, and it's just an analog station, but it's got RDS.
Okay.
And so that radio says, I know that I'm tuned to 105.7, and I know that based on the country code of the RDS signal that I'm getting, that this is 105.7, and I've gotten this additional data from the RDS or the HD radio transmitter ID. So I know that this is WXYZ, whatever, and I know that I can now build a URL based out of the – actually, I ping the DNS server if you want to get into it. And it comes back with the URL
that
I need to send.
In the RDS, we're already transmitting – is this called the ECC value or the PI value?
Right. That's exactly right. Okay. Those are the values it's looking for, And it comes back with those. And, the radio knows that gets that off the air. That's all it needs to create – the so-called fully qualified domain name that it can ping, that it can ping the DNS server with, and then the DNS server returns with the URL that the broadcaster has established for just this kind of synchronized enhancement data, and it allows you to still get the good real-time robust primary content over the air. But with this auxiliary content, which doesn't have to be quite so robust, you could lose it for, could drop out for a second or two and it wouldn't bother you. And, but you could put whatever it is. It's not, it doesn't have to be formatted in a certain way for the broadcast or constrained by the bandwidth of the broadcast channel because it's coming in over, Boku bandwidth via the internet. And it can change, you can put something new up there as long as it'll display in the internet domain. The standard also does give some guidance to the receiver manufacturers and to the broadcasters in terms of how they should format the data and what screen size it should be, so that there's some standard there so you don't cut off the head of the photo and so forth. And so this is a real nice, new, exciting place to see where we can expand in a very rapid an unconstrained way while we still maintain our primary service on the radio. And then we add this ever-increasing and open sort of enhancement data via the internet. And the DNS, radio DNS service is what ties the two together in a very simple way that does the broadcaster doesn't really have to do anything to enable other than provide the content. Radio will figure out, and as you tune to a new station, it automatically pings DNS and comes back with the URL for that station and so forth. So it's a very cool new system. So I recommend everybody looking at that for some possible impact on our future.
What will it take for this to become a real standard whereby there are enough stations doing this and enough receivers that follow along with this and it starts to become a real ecosystem and works?
Well, just that's pretty much the same as every new format that comes along. It's just got to get some traction. The nice thing about this is that it's not so much a chicken and egg as a typical broadcast format is like HD radio, where the broadcasters have to start putting it up and then the receivers manufacturers have to come around. Broadcasters are already doing it. It's basically sort of reverse engineered to fit what is most broadcasters are already doing. So it's really just a single-ended kind of thing that the radio manufacturers can put out, and they're incented to do it just because it'll sell more radios and makes more radio more interesting. The great beneficiary though is broadcasters, who all of a sudden get a whole new lease on life by having radio being having some parity to these other services, as we said earlier, and putting out a lot of and the ability this extra channel you just got, and you're already putting stuff on the internet anyway, so this isn't that big of a stretch to add this content. And again, one of the things we haven't mentioned yet, but it's possible to also include in this enhancement area is program guide content. In other words, for stations that do have varied programming, the idea that you could advance promote that programming or just announce it for maybe weeks in advance, and future radios that allow you to also pre-order a recording of some of this content coming up in the future, like an EPG does on a TiVo or a cable set-top box or a satellite box.
So I might be able to set my radio or some future device to say, I want to record whenever the Tennessee Volunteers Football Network is on the air.
Right.
I want to record that football game.
Right. And as long as the broadcaster is putting that content out through some means, And this is a project that I've been working on for the last couple of years that NAB has funded through their Fast Road project, how we would do that and how you would build the ecosystem for EPG and radio. It's no mean feat. It's a lot harder to do than television. For one thing, there's a lot more radio stations in the country, more than an order of magnitude more radio stations than TV stations. But more importantly, television program content, program information, schedule information was already being collected and had been for decades by the print industry to put into the newspaper. So there were a couple of companies who just did nothing but that, that all you had to do was just pick that, license that data up and put it. That's how TiVo was able to almost overnight put that content that had only been going into print into an electronic form and put it out over their service and enable their devices to have intelligence. So putting that together, there isn't any entity that's already collecting all that data for radio stations in the U.S. or really anywhere. So that's the biggest, first big challenge. And then figuring out how to transmit it to the receivers is the next challenge. We've just demonstrated in this project last summer in Boston. A number of the stations up there worked with us, and we put it out over an HD radio draft proposal. And we actually had an HD radio device that received it and displayed it. And we showed that at the NAB radio show as well. But we also put it out on the internet. And it was a lot easier to just develop a website that had this same data, and then you could search through it to find the station that you wanted. We made a little, we showed it on an iPhone. We showed it on a PC browser, and it was easy to find at least the program data. Now, these were devices that didn't have radios in them, so it was sort of this disembodied EPG. It was a program guide, but you couldn't just click on the program and then hear it. It was just an advisory to you. It was just telling you what was on at what station when, and then you could go to an actual radio and tune to it. So it wasn't very interactive in that sense, but it was at least giving the broadcaster a return, a real fast return on their going through the trouble of collecting this data, instead of having to wait for years for actual radios, HD radios to come out with this, which they very well might, and that would be nice at that point. In the meanwhile, you can have it delivered via the internet. And through something like this Radio DNS, you could have that content delivered to an actual radio, even an FM analog radio, or an AM analog radio. And AM stations, by the way, really would benefit from this because a lot of them are talk programmed and they do have program schedules, whereas a lot of FM stations are, you know, one format all the time. So there's not as much value to a program guide, but you could use that same program guide real estate to say, in this hour, Springsteen tickets giveaways. So tune in and put the phone number or call in and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of value to any kind of forward promotion that is not necessarily just program information. It could be just programming information about what's coming up on your station. So these are kinds of things we're thinking about that could be in our lifetime even, we hope, ways to really make radio that much more interesting and keep it up to speed with the other forms of the many other forms of oral content that and multimedia content that is being sent out to through various platforms to the public today. There's nothing wrong with radio in the sense that it can't also add these things or morph into these new platforms, whereas it's, and in the meanwhile, still has its installed base that is just phenomenally huge, as opposed to some of these other new providers who don't have that installed base to work off of. Plus the fact that even if we were to get into these other formats, and you hear a lot about mobile devices, iPhones, listening to streaming radio on your iPhone, Well, you know, if we did it, and I'd like to actually do this, is one of the projects I'd like to take on next year, to actually look at what the bandwidth occupancy really is. I knew a guy back in the early days of the internet television, interactive television. He worked for one of the companies that was trying to make this work, and he did some a study that showed that if you gave one Nielsen point to a program or a television program, one Nielsen point, which is not a very big audience, but that one show, if everybody on unicast internet connections around the country was trying to listen to that one Nielsen point ratings worth of audience, it would have taken up at the time 20% of the backbone of the entire internet. And that was one show with one rating point. Now think about how many shows are on TV at once and how many people are listening to them. You know, there's just no comparison between broadcast's ability to serve audiences in real time than as there is with the internet, no matter how much bandwidth and spectrum is allocated to it. But that's not what the internet and broadcast, that's not what the internet is trying to do, and it's got other values. So the two can really work together, and this is one of the things we're really thinking about. How can you add to the robustness and the capacity that broadcast radio has with some of these other perhaps personalized and enhanced new additional services and enhancements that you could add to your content in using the internet's two-way kind of not so robust and potentially clogged up occasionally configuration. So how can you kind of make the best of both work on this on a single platform? And that's the future of radio, I think, right there.
Skip, I've been looking at this website, radiodns.org. What can you tell me about this this outfit?
Well, it's a really kind of open source, no hierarchy kind of thing that a bunch of folks that came out of the new UK radio environment, most of whom have a lot of good, solid BBC background, and some of them have come up through the very young, still commercial radio environment in the UK. And have put together, you know, that's the one place where DAB really has taken off and is really working. And DAB radios have been outselling regular radios in the consumer market for the last several years there. It's a real kind of poster child for what you can do if you put a good collection of people together working from the radio stations, good content, good promotion, and good and cheap receiver availability. Those three things all sort of worked over there for DAB. And so now these folks are looking at ways that they can leverage the internet and radio together, and not just DAB, but also standard AM and FM radios as well. It's a pretty different marketplace over there, but they did include, to their credit, the HD radio capability in the very initial writing of this this standard, which is not 100% complete, but is pretty much almost there. And the group, as they say, is not really an entity. It's a very loosely formed entity, although they just did a few weeks ago elect a group of folks to try to formulate themselves into a little more of a organized org entity. And there's some American broadcasters among them, Jeff Littlejohn from Clear Channel, for one. I think there's about a dozen people that from around the world that are putting together the sort of organizational documents for this the statutes, as they call them, for this organization. And so we'll be hearing a lot more about them. As I say, they're really sort of a grassroots, sort of self-driven at this point. It's all been nobody's big money behind it. It's just really been a labor of love. And I think it's gonna work. I think it's already gotten a lot of attention around the world. And as I say, broadcasters are already using it. in the UK, and there's at least one radio, and we're looking at several more coming from perhaps for the, even this holiday season or shortly thereafter, that will receive it in the UK. And we'll see if that doesn't start showing up on this on our shores soon.
We'll put this in the show notes. If our listeners go to radiodns.org and then click the About tab at the website, there's a very good one-page description of the concept, the Radio DNS standard, and the governance of radiodns.org. I think that's pretty interesting and a very good short read, and will kind of get you up to speed on a lot of things that Skip has been talking about. There are also technical standards documents on that same website under the documentation tab, which will tell you about radio viz, radio tag, and radio EPG. A few other offshoots of the same concept, I suppose.
Right. Those are all applications underneath the DNS, radio DNS standard. There's things that they've thought of that you could enable through the radio DNS spec. And you'll see that it's all very, very simple stuff, as I've tried to hopefully explain a little bit here. And it's very easy to implement because broadcasters, essentially all they have to do is provide the content. There is no new standard, nothing new to broadcast, just something you put up online that the radios will find. You know, if
I'm trying to wrap my brain around something here, Skip. In the U.S., we have Ubiquiti, which is the promoter, the owner of the HD radio technology, and Ubiquiti is the one that's encouraging or working with radio manufacturers to make radios that will pick up their technology that broadcasters are broadcasting, paying for, licensing, and broadcasting. You also have a couple of different satellite radio providers, Sirius and XM, now one company, that are responsible for both ends of the experience, the transmission and the reception. How did the folks at Radio DNS and Pure come together to have this Sensia radio? And you know, it's not one company running both ends of the ecosystem. How did that come about, and how can we get more of that?
Well, the examples you pointed out are actually the exceptions to the rule worldwide. Most systems do take the other approach. In fact, that's the way FM essentially developed worldwide as well. It through a standards process, a true standards process. We can say there that the HD radio does have a standard, but that standard was kind of reverse engineered over the specs that were already developed in a proprietary fashion by Ubiquiti. And so that's really kind of an exception. Now, there's advantages to having a sort of a proprietary system or a single company because it behind it all, because it can drive the penetration, it can drive it to both the broadcaster and the receiver community. But on the other hand, the way DAB works, for example, in our recent history, it was a pure standard. It was developed by and ATSC is pretty close to this too for digital television. That's the way that works. There's no one company like Ubiquiti that's driving digital TV in this country, although some would say, well, there's maybe just two or three, but it's still, it was a true, much more of a true standards development process. A bunch of companies come together under the immunity from any kind of antitrust operations, because they're in a true standards development organization, an SDO, and they can sit down and discuss not things like pricing or licensing, but this just technology, until they come up with what they think is the best of breed technology. Now, maybe some of them have actual IP in that and or not, but that gets done later. After the spec is decided purely on its technical merits, then the standards development organization, under fairly strict rules, will decide how to come up with who's got IP, essential intellectual property in the spec, that this kind of merged technology specification that they've come up with. And then often there's a patent pool that is developed that allows implementers, broadcast equipment or receiver equipment manufacturers, to just go to one entity to license everything they need in to make that to make a device that works under that specification. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of very arcane, boring, perhaps standards process, but that's the way it works. Now, as I say, HD radio and satellite radio didn't really go in through either of those processes. Or in the case of HD radio, it went through the process, but sort of after it was all baked, and it was just one company's IP. So it is kind of a real sort of hybrid, no pun intended, approach to a standard. And it would only did that because the FCC really sort of asked them to do it. And the FCC even knew it was doing something unusual when it said HD radio will be the only digital radio for this country. Doing that was unprecedented to do that to a single company's technology that had been developed. Satellite radio, it was two different, and still is actually two different technologies, even though it's one company now. XM and Sirius use very, very different technologies, from the space satellite configurations to the hardware, consumer equipment, receiver hardware, and the terrestrial repeaters. They're all different. And they were developed sort of unilaterally, but in that case, basically FCC just said, here's the spectrum, go have fun. And the Sirius and XM respectively developed, again, unilateral sort of proprietary systems. And that's they take the risk. And then they drive the technology sort of unilaterally. That's one way to do it in America. That's as we see a common way to do it. But in other parts of the world and in other technologies like DTV, which is we have to say has been pretty successful in this country, you can do it in the more sort of by the book canonical or classical standards approach. Mm-hmm. And that's been the way we used to do it for radio, even. For AM, I guess you could say that kind of developed at an earlier time, but certainly for FM, it was the way. And I know there's a lot of quirks in history, and these things will continue to change, but it is a fascinating environment to see how things like this develop and how they can sort of take off organically. Man, there'll be some people who will argue that's the better way to do it, and others who will say, well, you know, better, faster, cheaper, less risk, or more sort of concentrated risk on one company. Isn't that better than having the risk distributed over so many companies that have to put speculative money in and then might see it fail? So, you know, I think it's different strokes, and we see both, and we have the perhaps the luxury of having both approaches available in this country.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I got to let my other co-hosts, if they have any follow-up questions to the things, that ideas you've presented here, Skip. We're unfortunately running pretty short on time here. Tom, Chris, and Chris, you have anything you want to follow up with?
I don't yet. I'm still trying to get my head around everything and understanding whether or not the business models that I'm currently working under, if the folks I work with have enough of a open mind to try and work with this, you know, go in this direction. Because it's amazing some of the things I hear in meetings about where the future of radio is going and how they're using the internet as a way to, you know, stir things up. And a lot of it seems to be missing the boat. And what Skip's talking about makes total sense.
Well, like they say, Chris, it's manage change or change managers.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's one of my little buzzwords that we like to throw around in the consulting business. But those are the things that kind of tend to resonate. And by that, by changing managers, I'm of course not implying exchanging, literally changing managers, but just changing their minds. Of course, I mean, at least that's the first step. You hope that one is all. That's the only step you need, but. Yeah, and that's the part of the problem with radio today is that a lot of the folks that are running it, and we can include many of ourselves in that, have been able to be successful just doing basically what we did yesterday. And it's not an environment that that is so agile. And yet all of a sudden now we're confronted with the need to be quite agile. And as we reach our dotage for many of us, it's tough. Tough for those old dogs to learn those new tricks, but it is possible. And I think it's perhaps essential. If this great industry and technology that we have and have developed over the years is to continue to thrive.
Well, Skip, thank you so much for joining us and being on the show. I really would like to have you back and give us an update on where this is going and maybe a couple of the other technologies and areas that you're interested in and working on. But I'm trying to wrap my brain around all the things that you said and think about the possibilities for my own radio stations. I'm part owner of four stations and then possibilities for me as a consumer, as a listener, and then possibilities for the company I work with, that being Telos, Omnia, and Axia. How can manufacturers be involved with this and in improving the experience that listeners have through working with radio stations and helping engineers to understand and management to understand what they can do to get this all going?
Yeah, we are in a great spot to do that, Kirk. Obviously, with your feet in all those different camps, and that's really what it's going to take. I think it's a big marketplace, and hopefully we can all continue to have it grow through some of the developments that we're talking about here.
Wow.
Look forward to coming back and talking more, and really appreciate you having me on tonight. Thanks, guys.
Skip, thanks for taking your time. Tom Ray, thanks for joining us from New York City and WOR Radio.
Anytime, Kirk. It's always a good time.
Chris Tarr from the frozen north part of Wisconsin.
The frozen tundra.
Where it's 12 degrees. Good gosh. And Chris Tobin from New York City, thank you for joining us from the Manhattan area. Sure appreciate
Always a pleasure.
Your participation. We'll be back next week with another This Week in Radio Tech. And you, the listeners, thank you for joining us. Please take a look at the show notes. We'll have URLs and details of some of the things that Skip talked about and contact information for all of us as well. Thank you for listening and tune in again next time. Download the next podcast of This Week in Radio Tech.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LaPay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.